From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. It's 5 a.m., and it's still dark out here at the San Francisco Wholesale Produce Market. There's a stampede of trucks and forklifts carrying loads of fresh fruits and vegetables to and from the warehouses. This is where the grocery stores go to grocery shop. In the Bay Area, this wholesale market is a place known for local goods, but in order to provide us with certain seasonal foods year-round, vendors buy from farms all over the world.
And we got some asparagus from Peru.
Eggplant and the squash out of Mexico.
Thyme and tarragon that comes from Israel.
Product that's coming as far as China, you know, Nicaragua, Chile and all that.
That's Robert from Yet Chung, a specialty produce vendor.
Are you guys known for any products specifically?
In this market, nobody really has the Asian product that we carry. Mm-hmm. For example, like lotus root, Shanghai bok choy, ginger, pure garlic and all that. It traveled by boat. It takes a few months to get there. And of course, once you get here, you got to go through custom.
So here we are, standing in a place where local and international foods are processed side by side. A place that connects farmers to the general public. We're surrounded by towering stacks of vegetables, neatly packed boxes of fruit, and an army of people moving it all around us. And these workers aren't your normal 9-to-5ers.
I'm Bob Pisa, owner of What a Tomato Produce Company.
When Bob's not selling tomatoes, he's competing in international drag boat races, and he holds a world record. So you might not wonder about a guy like Bob who gets your tomatoes onto the truck, or the person who unpacked a boatload of ginger.
Hi, my name is Spencer Levy. I am the banana ripener for Earl's Organics.
I didn't even know that was a thing, but there are people who ripen your bananas.
We're kind of like a triage for vegetables and fruit. It comes, after it's picked, it's starting to die. So it's up to us to get it to the customers at the best life expectancy for everybody.
A cast of thousands is responsible for the food we enjoy every day. They're all a part of this vast network of systems and processes that are pretty much invisible to us when we do our shopping for the week. The American supermarket has it all because of engineering, cheap transport, hard work, and government regulations that are supposed to keep our meals safe. In the next hour, we're going to revisit some stories that aired last fall and explore the hidden everyday networks that get our food to that neat display at our favorite store. And that's where we're headed next. Here we go, 3, 2, 1. And chicken has taken over the world. Chicken is no longer just the centerpiece of a special Sunday dinner. It's pretty much taken over the whole week. Americans eat a whopping 85 pounds of chicken per capita every year. It's become the most popular meat in the country, as many of us have begun eating less red meat.
That's a lot of nuggets.
That's Reveal reporter Catherine Miskowski.
Hi, Al.
Hey. So right now we are standing in front of a refrigerated case of chicken in our local grocery store.
It's a staggering amount of chicken, I gotta say.
It's a lot of chicken.
Wings, breasts, thighs, party wings.
I know, you can't go wrong with party wings.
You gotta go for the party wings.
So we are here because we wanted to talk about the S word. I feel a little weird saying this in a grocery store, but we want to talk about salmonella. So tell me a little bit about salmonella.
Well, salmonella is this bacteria that can live peacefully in the chicken's gut when the chicken is alive. And it doesn't really usually bother the chicken that much, but it can make us really sick if it's on our meat when we eat it.
How sick?
Well, you know, a lot of people think, oh, it's just like an upset stomach, but actually if the infection moves your bloodstream, it can kill you. It's actually legal to sell chicken that's contaminated with salmonella in the U.S. It's kind of amazing. A couple years back, there was a major outbreak. It was linked to this big California chicken producer, Foster Farms. It went on for over a year, and people from 29 states got sick. The strains of the bacteria were antibiotic resistant.
Fever, nausea, cramps, diarrhea. If you're having that within 3 days of eating chicken, you want to make sure you get seen. If you're very young, very old.
The big surprise, the plants were meeting the federal rules about salmonella at the time of the outbreak. The big producers tend to be pretty good at that. But still, hundreds of people got sick. Since then, the company has spent millions to clean up its act. But the outbreak raised a lot of questions about how safe our chicken is.
So since that outbreak, there's been a lot of awareness about what happens with the big producers. But we wanted to find out what's going on within the whole system. So we sent Catherine out on a road trip to see if she could find any salmonella-free chicken.
Yeah, and by looking at every step in the process, we found a gaping hole in our food safety system. Most of us still get our chickens from big poultry companies, but there are other options. If you're hardcore, you can raise them yourself in your backyard. Then there's the locavore movement, buying local chicken from smaller farms. We went to one of them, Gunthorpe Farms in northern Indiana. We met Greg Gunthorpe, a fourth-generation farmer who sells pasture-raised chickens.
They come in as day-olds. And then they spend 3 weeks here in the brooder barn, and then we put them out in the pasture. These will be 1 week tomorrow.
Greg sells his chickens as an alternative to the factory-farmed birds.
There's several things that make our chickens different. Our chickens get to be outside on pasture. We air-chill our chickens. They never get antibiotics. They're processed without chlorine. For the largest part of the year, they're delivered fresh within a couple days of when they're slaughtered.
Inside the barn, Greg shows us the baby chicks, who have already had quite a journey. They started as eggs at a breeder barn. Then they went to a hatchery where they, well, hatched. And as innocent as these chicks look, they may already have picked up salmonella at either place. Greg's first line of defense against salmonella? A vaccine.
We put just a very small amount of water in the bottom of it, and then put the vaccine in it, and you put droplets over them, and then they peck the droplets off from each other.
But that vaccine's not 100% effective, which means they could still get salmonella when they're turned out on the pasture when they're a few weeks old. It's nice for the birds that they get to roam around under a big open sky, but it's also another place where they can pick up the bacteria from wild birds, rodents, or each other. Up to this point, there has been absolutely no government regulation of salmonella in these birds. That's because food safety inspectors can't set foot on Greg's pastures. Here's Dr. Daniel Engeljohn, an official at the Food Safety and Inspection Service of the USDA.
Here in the United States, the authorities that my agency has begins at the slaughterhouse. So our authorities start there. We do identify that there are interventions that establishments can take that do focus on farm controls. So they can build those into their operations, but we don't regulate that.
So on the farm, there's no mandate to try to stamp out salmonella. Anything Greg does to fight it is up to him. But inside the slaughterhouse is a different story.
We're in the kill room.
Greg shows us how live birds are transformed into plucked and eviscerated chickens floating in an antimicrobial wash. It's pretty gory. Here, blood drips on the floor. Over there is a discarded chicken foot.
We'll hang them up on these shackles over here on our kill conveyor. Victor will stun them, and then he'll bleed them, and they'll ride around here. We'll throw them into the scalder here. This machine over here, the plucker, actually takes the feathers off.
Along the way, there are lots of chances for salmonella to pass from one bird to another. It may be on their feathers, skin, or feet, but it can also escape from their guts when they're eviscerated. Greg's daughter, Kara, described to us one of the many ways the workers are trying to keep the bacteria in check as the birds move down the line.
They use a gun to remove the neck, and we used to just remove the head and keep more of the neck on, but we found that that was actually a big determination in how much salmonella was on the bird, depending on how much of the neck he took off.
At the end of the line is a government-employed inspector. This is the first time the feds are checking the birds for salmonella. They didn't do it at the breeder barn, the hatchery, or out on the pasture. They wait till the kill.
USDA is going to stand down there on the end and look at every single bird that we slaughter today. They're going to be looking for two things. They're going to be looking to make sure that there's no systemic infection throughout the bird, so the bird's fit for human consumption. The other thing they're going to look for is that we didn't contaminate the bird.
Thank you. Today, Greg's plant killed about 1,700 birds. The USDA inspector usually samples just one bird, one out of that 1,700, to test for salmonella. But the day we visited, the inspector didn't even do that. She wouldn't speak to us, but the agency said in an email later that we just happened to visit when they were transitioning from one sampling approach to another. Since the beginning of this month, the USDA has been regularly testing cut-up chicken parts, too, in addition to the whole bird. Greg's chicken hasn't been linked to any illnesses from salmonella. But it turns out small and local is not necessarily better when it comes to stamping out the bacteria. Here's Dr. Engeljohn again from the USDA.
It isn't true to say that all small manufacturers have poor performance, but overall, our data would suggest that poultry is more likely contaminated with salmonella in our smaller operations than in our larger operations.
One reason is that some very small plants like Greg's purposely don't use certain chemicals like chlorine on the meat to get rid of the bacteria. In fact, for them, it's a selling point. And the birds we saw killed were destined for plates later that week.
We'll start sorting them and cutting them up tonight, and then they'll all be in restaurants by Wednesday or Thursday. We have about 6 or 8 places that we supply. The rest of the places, they'll be served as specials on Friday or Saturday evening.
All right, Catherine, I got to be honest. This is not looking good for our quest to find a salmonella-free chicken to cook.
You're right. The bottom line when it comes to salmonella in chicken in the U.S. is buyer beware. The official advice for consumers focuses on cooking the raw meat thoroughly and handling it safely. But that's harder than you might think. There's a danger of contaminating the knife, the cutting board, or even the kitchen sink.
Okay, so should I just opt out of the system, go DIY, build a coop, and start raising my own chickens in my backyard?
We wondered that too. So the next stop on our salmonella road trip was with a family in Felton, Pennsylvania. They'd raised backyard chickens. That's about as local as you can get.
I guess we don't have to lock the car.
Yeah.
It's easy to picture chickens at Deanna and Dan Gabriel's place.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Beautiful here.
A stream runs through the backyard. The chickens even used to drink out of it. But these days, there are no chickens here. The Gabriels buy their eggs in the grocery store. Deanna showed us the sorry remains of their chicken coop.
It's a mess now and overgrown after 2 years, but they were in that wire kennel kind of thing there. We actually ripped the coops down and burned them, so the fire pile is over there. But you can still see the metal nesting box kind of sitting in the middle there, which was inside the coop.
The chickens were a family project, although this wasn't their 14-year-old son's idea of a good time. He was more into lacrosse and football. Backyard farming, not so much. Here's his dad, Dan.
His taking care of the chickens entailed him flipping up the gate, going back, play his video games, letting them in at night. That's his taking care of chickens.
In July 2013, their son, the Gabriels asked us not to use his name, started having chest pains. And they said he had trouble breathing and developed a 103-degree fever. He was in severe pain. He couldn't even lie down. At the hospital, the doctors suspected cancer. Maybe leukemia, lymphoma. He had a massive growth in his chest.
I don't think the doctors really knew what was going on, but they knew it was getting worse. They were really concerned. So we had like the head of the department and a whole bunch of other doctors that kind of came in and had a round table discussion with us. And they were like, you know, we have to do something.
The initial debrief after the surgery with the surgeon, he was real concerned. He confirmed that it looked cancerous. He was starting to build up fluid around the sac around his heart and the sacs around his lungs. So they put a tube in his chest.
But when they pulled the tube out, things got even worse.
And then fluid started shooting out across the room. The intern was running around, what do I do, what do I do? I point to him and go, get the head of this ICU right now.
It wasn't cancer. He had an infection caused by salmonella. And he hadn't even eaten the chicken. He just came into contact with the bacteria. It took their son almost a year to recover.
We took every precaution. We knew the inherent risks of salmonella. And thankfully, we sought medical treatment when we did.
The source of his illness was the chicks that they'd bought that spring at Tractor Supply, a billion-dollar farming mega chain. It was selling chicks from a hatchery in Ohio, which had been having trouble with salmonella for years.
Almost 100 people sick tonight in 23 states, and the source of the illness is being traced to a hatchery in Mount Healthy.
When the Gabriels bought the chicks in spring of 2013, they had no idea that Mount Healthy hatcheries had been linked in the past 2 years to hundreds of illnesses and two deaths. The Gabriel family eventually reached a settlement with Tractor Supply. No one from the farming megastore would talk to us on tape, but a spokesperson said that they didn't sell chicks from Mount Healthy hatcheries in their stores this year.
I just wanted to check in and see if we might be able to come by and speak with Rob.
Our producer, Jillian Weinberger, tried to get us into Mount Healthy hatcheries to find out what exactly had gone wrong there and what were they doing about it. But owner Rob O'Hara wouldn't talk to us.
No, he's not going to be available, and there's nobody else here that could do it either.
And he knows that we're speaking with someone who claims that his chicks made her son very sick, and we just wanted to give him a chance to respond.
Right, I know, and I told him, but he's not going to be available.
Well, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
We did get some answers from the Ohio Department of Agriculture. Their investigation found that the source wasn't the Mount Healthy facility in Ohio. That was clean. It came from other companies who supplied eggs and chicks to Mount Healthy. And those suppliers were out of state.
So the Gabriels got the chicks from a store in Pennsylvania who got them from a company in Ohio that was getting the contaminated chicks from their suppliers someplace else?
Right. And Mount Healthy also sells by mail order. So it was turning around and sending the chicks carrying the bacteria all over the country. So the Gabriel's chicks in their backyard were connected to this whole national supply chain.
And it seems like no matter where we get our chicken from, big companies, small farmers, or even backyard chickens, there's still a risk of salmonella. And what you found out is that no matter where you get your chickens, the only place it's regulated is in the slaughterhouse. And even there, it's kind of spotty. So where does that leave us?
The U.S. isn't the only place that has struggled with this problem. There was a big problem with salmonella in chicken in Denmark, where chicken is also popular. Here's a commercial from one of their big chicken producers.
Programmet præsenteres af Danpo. Mad med glæde.
Back in the 80s, Denmark saw a spike in illness from salmonella, but they completely revamped their system to make their chickens almost salmonella-free. They do it by monitoring for the bacteria before the chicks are even hatched, screening even the grandparent flocks. Throughout the chicken's life, the Danes implement strict biosecurity measures to keep the birds from getting infected. Over there, entering a barn full of chicks is almost like getting ready for surgery.
And we unlock the door because we want a closed door to the henhouse because we don't want any visitors just entering the house.
Farmer Leif Barsbala showed us what he has to do when he enters a chicken house.
We have a stop sign on the door that says it's not allowed to enter the door because of salmonella and campylobacter. Now I wash my hands and put some soap on. And we put coveralls on and the boots. Now we can enter the house and we close the door behind us. If we get salmonella in this house, we have to destroy the whole house.
He changes into a different pair of coveralls and boots before he enters each chicken house on the farm. And those boots, actually, are one secret to keeping their birds salmonella-free.
We get a test kit. At the same time, we get new day-old birds. In the test set, there's 5 pair of elastic socks. We can pull over the boots. We're entering the house. So they stick manure to the socks, and those socks are mailed to the laboratory, and they test it for salmonella.
So Danish farmers are using boots and socks to test the poop they step in?
You got it. Manure-covered socks. Gross and kind of genius, because bacteria on those socks will reveal if the flock is infected. And when salmonella turns up in a Danish chicken flock, that raw meat can't be sold in the supermarket. If it is sold, it has to be cooked before consumers ever get near it.
I mean, that sounds like a good plan. I won't be getting my socks dirty anytime soon. And ultimately, though, what you're telling me is that I should plan my next vacation to Denmark if I want to buy raw chicken that's salmonella free.
Pretty much. Denmark produces much less chicken than we do, and their chicken is more expensive, so the American chicken industry is not looking to follow their lead anytime soon.
So where does that leave us in our quest to find a salmonella-free chicken to cook for dinner?
Well, things aren't looking great. For chicken pieces like breasts, wings, and thighs, there are new salmonella rules, but they still allow 15% of chicken parts to be contaminated. And the chicken industry says, overall, they're doing a good job. Here's Dr. Ashley Peterson from the National Chicken Council.
Americans eat about 160 million servings of chicken every day, and almost every one of them is done safely.
Still, about 200,000 Americans get sick from salmonella in poultry each year.
That's Reveal reporter Catherine Miskowski. She worked on that story with producer Jillian Weinberger. Thanks, Catherine.
Thanks, Al.
When we come back, a spot that's even further north than Leif's farm in Denmark. We head to a U.S. town in the Arctic Circle and find out what it takes to keep fresh fruits and vegetables in our supermarkets year-round. It comes with risks, especially to farm workers. That story when we return on Reveal.
Listeners, Julia B. Chan here. If chicken is one of your favorite foods, right about now you might be wondering how to keep salmonella from spreading in your kitchen. Well, don't worry, I've got you covered. Go to revealnews.org/saferchicken to learn 5 simple things you can do to protect you and yours from salmonella. They're tips on how to handle your chicken from the store to the stove. We've made it easy for you to save the tip sheet to your phone or favorite device for quick reference, too. That's revealnews.org/saferchicken.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Today, we're taking another look at the secret histories and networks behind everyday foods.
Good afternoon, Stacey.
Hey, could I speak with the manager?
Hold on.
Recently, one of our producers, Delaney Hall, called up a guy named Tom Schieser. He manages a grocery store in Barrow, Alaska, which is a little community way up at the very top of the state.
Yeah, it's actually the northernmost community in the U.S. You cannot get any further north. I called Tom on a very special mission.
Good afternoon, AC. This is Tom.
Which was to find strawberries in the most unlikely place I could think of. What's Barrow like? How would you describe it to someone who's never been there before?
Well, the average annual temperature here is about -9 degrees. It's just, we're in the high Arctic. So
wow.
In the winter, just about Thanksgiving, the sun will go down and not show itself again until the beginning of February.
Tom said temperatures in Barrow can drop to -57 degrees. Everyone rides snowmobiles. He said it's like living inside the Discovery Channel. Anyway, I finally cut to the chase. Tell me about your produce selection there. I mean, what kind of produce do you carry?
Basically a little bit of everything, fruits, vegetables, and a full assortment.
Okay, do you carry strawberries?
We do carry strawberries.
Even when it's -57?
Yes, ma'am.
Wow.
Yeah, our produce section looks a lot like what you would see in the lower 48.
Well, thanks so much, Tom. I really appreciate it.
You bet.
Okay, bye.
At this point, we're used to living in a world where you can get most produce year-round. But let's just pause and consider that for a minute, because this situation defies nature. Strawberries are delicate. They're prone to disease. They're hard to ship. And yet, you can find them pretty much any time of the year, anywhere in the United States. That's because farmers have figured out how to grow them all the time in a very particular coastal climate, mostly in California. The story of how this happened has a lot of twists and turns, and it actually reveals something about how dangerous technology from the military finds its way into agriculture. The old idea of swords to plowshares from the Bible. This particular story goes all the way back to World War I. Here's Delaney.
The most iconic images of World War I are of trenches, dug into the ground, protected by long coils of barbed wire, full of men in combat gear. Trench warfare was ugly and slow. The only way to gain ground was to rush the opposing army's trench. So to break the stalemate, the Germans came up with an idea.
They hit upon the idea of releasing clouds of chlorine gas, letting it drift across the trenches to soldiers, Allied soldiers on the other side, and poison them.
This is Edmund Russell.
I'm a professor of history at the University of Kansas.
The Germans hoped the chlorine gas would give them a decisive victory and end the war. But instead, it led to a chemical arms race. The U.S. set up a whole new division in the military called the Chemical Warfare Service.
Both sides spent enormous effort to develop new and more powerful poison gases, as well as ways to protect against them. This is the war in which gas masks, which are familiar images to us now, were first developed.
One of the gases developed around this time was called chloropicrin. It was a tiny molecule, so tiny that it could actually slip through the filter of a gas mask. Once inside, chloropicrin would make soldiers throw up,
which would lead the soldier to rip the mask off and expose him to the other more dangerous gases, such as mustard gas.
As you might expect, these gases were controversial. They could kill soldiers in slow and agonizing ways, and a strong breeze could carry them off the battlefield and into nearby towns, hurting civilians. When the war ended, the Chemical Warfare Service didn't destroy these poisonous chemicals like you might have expected them to do. Instead, they decided the chemicals just needed a good, old-fashioned rebranding campaign.
So they started emphasizing these civilian uses of chemical weapons and, in fact, said we really should not be called the Chemical Warfare Service. We should be called the Chemical Peace Service because that's mainly what we are doing.
The Chemical Warfare Service, or Peace Service, came up with an especially novel civilian use for all their leftover chloropicrin, the vomiting gas. They shipped it to the pineapple fields of Hawaii.
So in Hawaii, they were growing pineapples like they do in Hawaii, and they were dealing with problems in the soil, pests and diseases that could really just wipe out the crop.
Andy Donahue is an editor here at Reveal. He's our resident strawberry expert, and he knows something about pineapples, too.
What's in the soil are these things called nematodes, which are essentially little worms.
The worms would latch onto the pineapples and slowly strangle them. They were devastating to crops. So some pineapple researchers figured maybe they could use this chemical, chloropicrin, to help wipe out the bugs. They used these handheld guns to inject the gas down into the soil, and the yields just skyrocketed.
Lo and behold, they get these amazing results. There's something like 20 tons more pineapples they could grow per acre. That was sort of the dawn of the era of using these kind of gases in agriculture.
A whole new kind of pesticide was born, fumigants. A couple decades passed, and the California strawberry industry picked up on this new technology. By the 1970s, most strawberry farmers were using fumigants, and once again, the yield skyrocketed. Only this time it was kind of a problem. Farmers were growing way more strawberries than people were eating. Back then, people still thought of the fruit as a delicacy.
Kind of the attitude about strawberries was they were something really you set aside for a special occasion.
This is Dave Riggs, and in 1977, he became the advertising manager for what was then known as the California Strawberry Advisory Board. It was a trade group. Dave's goal was to expand our appetite for strawberries, to turn them from a special occasion fruit into an everyday fruit. He started working on something called tie-ins. That's when products get together to promote each other.
For example, you might have avocados and salsa and Doritos going together on a big Cinco de Mayo ad.
Dave set out to fashion tie-ins for strawberries. Strawberries and cereal, strawberry daiquiris. Even that iconic Cool Whip container with the strawberries on it, that didn't happen by accident.
California strawberries. Imagine how good they'd be, fresh. With shortcake in October, or on a frosty morning in November,
At any time of year, fresh California strawberries would be perfect with almost anything. So why buy them now? Because they're here now.
In addition to the tie-ins, every year Dave would make a pilgrimage to New York to meet with the editors of the seven largest women's magazines.
Well, what do they call them? The Seven Sisters in New York, Ladies' Home Journal and Red Book and Good Housekeeping and those type of magazines.
He'd suggest ideas for strawberry-related recipes and articles. And his annual pilgrimage worked.
I remember one year I was counting among the big seven magazines that we actually got more magazine covers than Lady Di, which we thought was a pretty good accomplishment.
The strawberry was the new celebrity fruit. And this came after a few other important developments, like the construction of the interstate highway system, which made it easier to ship fruit, and the invention of the clamshell packaging, which protected strawberries while they were on the road. Andy says the effect of all this history was that Americans started eating a lot more strawberries.
Like, a lot more strawberries. It went from being this sort of seasonal delicacy that you could get for a few weeks or months near where you lived to becoming a real year-round staple of the American diet. So where in the 1970s, the average American ate 2 pounds of strawberries, a year we now eat 8 pounds of strawberries.
If you multiply that by the population of the U.S., you get more than 2 billion pounds of strawberries consumed nationally every year. Andy Donahue and his team of reporters here at Reveal have spent a lot of time understanding what this means. Because the modern strawberry industry was built on fumigants. And as our appetite for strawberries has grown, so has the amount of pesticides needed to grow them. Back in World War I, people worried that poisonous gases could blow off the battlefield and into nearby communities. 100 years later, agricultural fumigants still have the exact same problem.
Because these gases are injected into the soil, they don't stay there, right? They raise up out of the ground and they just sort of enter the air. And what we're beginning to learn, or have been learning actually for quite a while, is this can have really bad effects on the environment and on human health.
One fumigant called methyl bromide has been linked to the breakdown of the ozone layer. It's now slowly being phased out of use. Other fumigants have been linked to cancer or to birth defects and developmental problems.
So you had women who were pregnant that lived or worked around these fields, and the study has shown, you know, smaller heads, developmental problems, smaller birth weights, those sort of things.
In one case, Andy's team found that California had allowed growers to use way more of a cancer-causing pesticide than scientists thought was safe, right next to schools and homes. Now, the pesticides aren't harmful to consumers, those of us who eat them. But for the people who live and work in these communities, it's a different story.
And that is what we will get into in our next segment. It takes us to the fields of Florida, where farm workers have taken on some of the biggest restaurant chains in the country in order to improve conditions in the fields. That story was produced by Delaney Hall and Andy Donahue. It was based on reporting by Kendall Taggart and Bernice Yearn. To read more about the dark side of the strawberry and to learn what you should ask when you're thinking about buying them, visit revealnews.org. Stay with us.
No matter what you make, hey, make it great with strawberries in it. And it only takes a minute. Freeze 'em, shake 'em, sugar 'em, bake 'em. Any way you make 'em makes it clear that California strawberries give you very good ideas. Strawberries give you lots of berries. Strawberry good, very good ideas.
Hey there, Lindsay Greenbarber here, Reveal's Director of Strategic Research. For the past couple of years, I've been creating an impact tracker for newsrooms. It's a first-of-its-kind online tool that helps journalists catalog the effects of their stories, from public conversations to laws that get changed. Today, the tracker is finally ready to deploy, and it's free to anyone who wants it. Just head over to revealnews.org/tracker for instructions on how to install it. Once again, that's revealnews.org/tracker.
You're listening to Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and today we're looking at where our food comes from. I think it's really easy to just take for granted that food just magically shows up at the grocery store. I mean, we know that someone had to get us the food, but most of us, at least I don't tend to think about it. I just get what I need and go from there. Take, for example, strawberries. I love strawberries. They don't last a day in my household. Crazy thing is, that case that those strawberries came in is the same packaging that farm workers used in the field after picking the fruit. Strawberries don't go from the field to a processing and packing plant. They go from farm to distribution to market. The work to collect the fruit isn't easy. The workers have to bend over at the waist to pick, moving at lightning speed. They deal with pesticides and fumigants. It's very low paid, and sometimes it's abusive and unfair. I didn't know about any of this until I took a trip to Southwest Florida, not too far outside of Tampa, to see the strawberry fields of the Sunshine State.
Hola.
Jesus Garcia lives in a small trailer with his wife and four kids. It's rainy and there's no work, so he's home practicing on his keyboard. That's actually one of the challenges of strawberry work. On any given day, you don't know if you'll be earning anything.
Mi nombre es Jesús García. Soy originario del estado de Oaxaca, México.
Jesús is 33. He moved here about 10 years ago from southern Mexico. He says he earns between $1,000 to $2,000 a month during strawberry season. So that's between $5,000 to $8,000 a year. And he says the work comes with risks.
Bueno, para...
To begin with, when we are preparing the earth or laying down plastic, the very first thing that they do is apply a very strong pesticide. And then once we're picking again, another round of pesticides. It's just pure chemicals. And sometimes the people who are doing the fumigation don't care or pay attention to where the workers are, even if they're spraying the same field or a field over.
Jesus says that the people doing the spraying have protective gear, but he and other workers don't.
You breathe in a lot of gas, and sometimes you feel like you're drowning, like you can't breathe. And many people are allergic or have different symptoms, but they don't speak up about that because they're afraid of being fired. Or maybe they go to the office, but they don't do anything about it.
But Jesus's main complaint isn't the chemicals. It's the other working conditions. Some days he says he's forced to wait for hours, unpaid, before the bosses say it's okay to start working. Other days he says there's no shade or toilets or drinking water. He says the bosses curse at the workers for moving too slow.
What we need is just the bosses or supervisors to treat us well. But the fact is, without us, the company isn't anything. But also without them, we can't do anything. So we need to come together, the bosses and the workers, and that way we'll do good work, and they won't discriminate against us. They won't be mistreatment against the workers. That's all we really want.
These are issues that we still struggle with.
Mike Rios works for the U.S. Department of Labor. He's in charge of enforcing labor laws on farms across the Southeast. He says he sees a wide range of violations, like employers paying migrant workers less than minimum wage and providing unsafe transportation and unsanitary housing, and sometimes not paying workers at all.
And in the strawberry industry, we tend to have a higher percentage of these violations. Just to give you a quick example, out of the Tampa District Office, in 2014, we conducted 30 investigations of strawberry growers, and fully 26 of them were found in violation. So as you can tell, the compliance rate is pretty dismal. It's around 14%.
Wow, only four of them were actually doing the right thing.
Correct.
So this is pretty widespread. It's not just a few bad apples.
It tends to be, yes. And we've been working with the strawberry industry as much as we can to try to get compliance rates up. But for whatever reason, we are indeed having a little bit of a struggle with trying to bring compliance numbers up in strawberries.
We asked the Florida Strawberry Growers Association to sit down for an interview, but instead, they sent us a written statement. It said they're concerned and disappointed by the Labor Department's findings, and they're working closely with the department both to fix the problems and to clarify the rules. As for fumigants and pesticides, they said their goal is to comply with the regulations. And those regulations are getting tougher. This year, new EPA rules went into effect, which are designed to enhance protections for agricultural workers. And Congress also passed a bill to place stricter rules on chemical safety across the country. But farm worker groups say rules alone are rarely enough. Migrant workers hardly ever submit complaints. Many are undocumented, and others come from places where authorities just can't be trusted. Even if they did complain, there aren't nearly enough government inspectors to go around. But there may be another way to go. That's the sound of workers dropping green tomatoes into white plastic buckets in a Florida field. For decades, Florida's tomato workers endured the same sorts of abuses Jesus Garcia says he's experiencing, not to mention well-documented cases of sexual assault, child labor, and even modern-day slavery. In the early 90s, a group of migrant workers from Mexico, Haiti, and Central America started to organize in the town of Immokalee, in the heart of Florida's tomato country. First, they tried to convince local growers to improve conditions. They won some concessions, but progress was piecemeal and slow. So they had another idea. Why not go up the food chain to the big supermarkets and fast food restaurants that really call the shots in agriculture today?
Señores, atención, por favor. No compre más en Taco Bell.
Don't buy anymore at Taco Bell.
Taco Bell is part of
the... They tried boycotts, hunger strikes, and protests like this one at a Florida Taco Bell in 2003.
Don't support the corporations that are part of this exploitation.
Finally, in 2005, Taco Bell agreed to buy all of its tomatoes from growers who committed to a strict code of conduct, including shade, toilets, clean drinking water, and zero tolerance for sexual harassment, child labor, or other abuses. Pizza Hut, McDonald's, and Burger King followed. So did Whole Foods and Trader Joe's. And then, in 2014, the really big one, Walmart. In all, 14 corporations have signed on to what's called the Fair Food Program. The Florida Tomato Growers Exchange, which represents more than 90% of the state's tomato farms, also signed on after years of resisting. By all accounts, the change on the ground has been dramatic.
It's like night and day.
Gerardo Reyes Chavez is in his late 30s. He's been working in the fields since he was an 11-year-old kid in Mexico. For the past 15 years, he's also been a member of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. We meet up at the coalition's office, a big, busy room plastered with posters from past campaigns.
When somebody is treated with respect, when the dignity is highlighted as a central piece of the workplace, the workers are not going to just like unlearn that. It becomes something that is ingrained into who they are as human beings. So it's really powerful.
Gerardo explains how the Fair Food Program works. First off, the retailers agree to pay an extra penny a pound for their tomatoes, which goes straight to the workers as a bonus. That can translate into $50, even $80 a week, a sizable chunk of money given how little they earn. But even more important than the cash is a 24-hour hotline for complaints, managed not by farm owners, but by a nonprofit third-party group called the Fair Food Standards Council. Gerardo says it's successful because it comes from the workers.
It's created by workers. It's overseen by workers. And when there are problems happening, the workers themselves become the eyes of the entire Fair Food program. That is what we call the worker-driven social responsibility. So that is the difference, and we need to recognize it so that we don't get confused when we hear corporations saying that they are already doing their part.
We often say that we are enforcement obsessed.
That's Laura Safer Espinoza, a former New York State Supreme Court judge who heads the Fair Food Standards Council.
One can have all the standards one wants, but at the end of the day, if there is no monitoring and if there is no real enforcement mechanism, you can bet that those standards will look good on paper, but they will not impact people's lives.
She says the monitoring group has investigated and resolved more than 1,100 worker complaints. It has the power to suspend growers from the program if they don't fix the problems. That's a big deal. If the growers get kicked out, they lose some of their biggest buyers.
This is a market-based solution that has brought Florida's tomato industry from a place that was known as ground zero for modern-day slavery to one of the best workplace environments in U.S. agriculture in the space of 4 or 5 seasons.
Laura says now is the time to take the Fair Food Formula to other crops in other states. In recent months, organizers have been fanning out across Florida and up the East Coast looking for places to expand. And they're getting help from some unlikely sources.
We are approaching the entrance to one of our farms.
John S. Forms is a co-CEO of Pacific Tomato Growers, one of the 5 biggest tomato producers in the United States. He shows me one of his properties, 3,500 acres of farmland, about a half hour southeast of Tampa.
And this piece of ground here is where we are going to start our newest venture, which is our entry into the strawberry business.
Why strawberries? Why just change it up?
The main reason that we chose strawberries was that as a member of the Fair Food Program in our tomato fields, we were watching on the sidelines as no one was willing to move into strawberries with the Fair Food Program. And quite frankly, we wanted to push forward this agenda. So we're growing strawberries.
We go into a bare bones office on the farm to talk. John says he started taking a closer look at how his family business was treating workers after struggling with addiction.
I'm a recovering alcoholic and addict. I ended up on the streets of Los Angeles pushing a shopping cart. Part of my recovery involved a lot of introspection.
John says his company has always prided itself on treating its workers fairly. It even joined other growers in a voluntary monitoring program to cut down on worker abuses. But in 2007, one of the company's subcontractors was convicted in a highly publicized slavery case in which a dozen migrant workers were beaten and chained. It drove home the point that companies like his weren't very good at policing themselves. So in 2010, John convinced his people at Pacific to become the first tomato grower to join the Fair Food Program.
You know, one of the things you hear in these type of issues is that I'd love to address them, I'd love to do more, but I just don't have the money. I can't afford it. So what is your response when people say stuff like that?
What we're talking about here with the Fair Food Program are basic fundamental human rights and human dignities. We're talking about obeying the law. If you need to break the law to make a living and make your business model work, first of all, I hope you get caught. And if you don't get caught, I hope you make the decision to get out of the business.
Continuing Rutland Road for 8 miles.
So here's where the story comes full circle. Remember Jesus Garcia, the farm worker who was complaining about conditions in the strawberry fields? Well, he's got a new job at John S. Form's new strawberry farm. It's a cloudy day when I visit, almost cool. There are about a dozen men and women inching along the troughs between the raised beds covered in plastic. Buddy Hill is the farm manager.
This is an organic strawberry field. Right now we are just pulling weeds because organics, you don't have herbicides that you need to get rid of the weeds. So this crew is just trying to clean it up and get the weeds out of the way so these little babies can grow.
Jesus. Hola.
Jesus is there in jeans and t-shirt and a ball cap. What's it like working here in comparison to the other places that you've worked at?
Here I'd say 100% they've treated us well. In comparison to the other companies where I've been, it's totally different, the treatment between this company and the other company. The situation was very difficult for the workers in terms of the supervisors in charge of the farm.
He says even the bathrooms are cleaner. It's still the early days and he doesn't want to jump to conclusions, but so far, he's happy with his new gig. A bit of a postscript. Since this first aired, the Fair Food Program now covers large tomato operations in Georgia, the Carolinas, Virginia, Maryland, and New Jersey. And an estimated 35,000 workers are now covered under the Fair Food Program. The first Fair Food strawberries have hit the shelves and the program's expanding. It now includes green bell peppers. You'll notice produce packages have a small green sticker. It says Fair Food with a picture of a field laborer on it, which brings us back to the supermarket. Thanks to Jonathan Miller for producing this story. Networks, logistics, infrastructure, all the various ways that food gets to us. But at the center of these complex systems is one thing, people. And like people, those networks can be flawed. I think it's safe to say that our food networks have issues. Sure, we can get almost any food we want pretty much at any time of the year we want. But at what cost? What we see in Immokalee is in stark contrast to what we see in our grocery stores. Everything in the stores is bright and happy, but not so much in the field, where life can be pretty tough. But change is possible. The living and working conditions of tomato workers improved after they organized and pushed for reform. But that reform didn't happen until consumers, everyday people, forced big corporations to see what was going on behind the scenes. So the next time you're at the store and you pick up a container of strawberries, think about the hand that picked that fruit. Ultimately, we vote for or against change in our complex food systems with our dollars. Speaking of strawberries, head over to our website, revealnews.org, to watch an animation of a brief history of the modern strawberry, featuring the voice of our public radio buddy, Roman Mars of 99% Invisible. Our show was edited by Taki Telenitis, and our lead producer was Delaney Hall. Updates were produced by Julia B. Chan and edited by David Richard. We had additional help from producers John Miller and Jillian Weinberger and managing editor Andy Donahue. Our sound design team is the Wonder Twins, my man Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Claire C. Note Mullen. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Our head of studio is Krista Scharfenberg. Amy Powell is our editor-in-chief. Suzanne Reaver is our executive editor, and our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.